I'd like to call this meeting of the Energy Committee to order. Our first guest has a three-hour drive ahead of him, so I really would like us to get going as close to on time as we can. Thank you to everybody who came out this evening. I hope for legislators who have other jobs, this was a convenient time for an interim hearing. Tonight we're going to be talking about community solar. The big impetus for the hearing was to hear about the program that Xcel has proposed in response to the solar energy bill that we passed last year. But there's also some outstanding voluntary efforts going on by the co-ops in Minnesota. And so we're going to start with a presentation by Tim Thompson from Lake Region Electric Cooperative on the program that they have voluntarily put together on solar. Please state your name and your affiliation before you speak.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tim Thompson. I'm the CEO at Lake Region Electric Cooperative, headquartered in Pelican Rapids. And I'm really pleased to have the opportunity to be here this evening to share with you our story of what we are doing at our electric cooperative to bring community solar to our member owners. I provided a handout for everybody. I hope you've got a copy in front of you on the first page there. It's titled, A Cooperative Solar Solution. And my quote there on that first page, I think, really captures where we're at. We are bringing renewable energy to rural Minnesota, just like we brought electricity to the countryside 75 years ago. Earlier this year, our board of directors, who are elected by our members, approved a solar business plan for our cooperative. At the heart of that business plan is a goal of making sure that our project is good for all of our members. Those members who want to invest in the community solar project and receive that solar energy from that project, as well as the other 26,000 members of our entire co-op. This demonstrates, and I hope to demonstrate to you tonight, how a market-based co-op model can work for all of us. I believe our model is one that legislators and rural electric cooperative members can be very proud of. So what I'd like to do tonight is just walk through where we're at with our project. We're actually right in the midst of the construction phase of a 40 kW solar array at our headquarters in Pelican Rapids, and I'll try to bring that to life for you the best that I can. But before I do that, if you could turn to page 2, it's just a brief overview of our cooperative with some of the key statistics and things about our cooperative and a map of our state. Lake Region Electric is one of the member owners of Great River Energy. We're part of the Great River Energy family of cooperatives. And on the second page there, you can see that our cooperative has about 26,000 members, 70 employees, 5,600 miles of line. And one of the things that makes it very unique at our cooperative is the fact that we have over 1,000 lakes in our service territory, which brings a lot of people from across our country to our cooperative. In fact, a very interesting statistic about our cooperative is we have members from all 50 states in our country. In the last box at the bottom there, one of the things we're quite proud of is we've recently been recognized by the Arbor Day Foundation as one of the few certified Treeline USA utilities. And we received that based on our vegetation management program and how we balance the utility needs with the beauty of our trees and our beautiful area. On page 3, I've just provided you the top page, if you will, of our strategic plan that our board of directors approves each year. It's our pyramid of success, as we call it, with our vision, mission, and strategic imperatives. Just a couple things real quickly on this page. The first word of our vision is leading, and that's exactly what we are trying to do, is be a leader in bringing these new and emerging technologies to our membership. And if you look down the page, more towards the bottom, one of our six strategic imperatives is to be a smart energy leader. And in that imperative, it includes not only bringing competitive energy to our membership, but also being a provider of environmental and conservation leaders for our members. Page 3 of my handout is just a snapshot for you of the different types of new things that are happening today in our footprint of our service territory. I've been at Lake Region 6 years, and if you'd have told me 6 years ago that we'd have a large wind farm being built in our area, that's actually the picture of the equipment being hauled into our service territory for the Lakes Wind Farm in our area. They're erecting 32 1.5 megawatt turbines in our area. About 3 years ago, we made a decision when we got word about this farm coming to our area that we wanted to partner with them the best we could to make this, allow this to come to fruition in a very positive way in our area. And I'm pleased to report that that's worked out very well for us. While we are not a part of that wind farm, because we're local, and we know the farmers, the landowners, we worked very closely with them to the best we could. And in the end, they were so thankful for that, they paid us. Where we intersected, when our distribution line was interfering with the transmission line they need to build, they paid us to put our lines underground, and it's just been a very positive experience all the way around for all of us. Of course, solar. We have three members now who have installed solar at their homes, and of course, we're going to be bringing the community solar to our area. The natural gas, there's even natural gas distribution lines being considered, ran out into some of the lakes area that we serve. And down in the left-hand corner is a picture of LED technology that seems to be picking up very quickly, and another technology that we're looking at bringing to our members as part of a conservation program. On page 5, just want to let you know that we are a cooperative who also installs geothermal loops for our members. We're very unique this way. The picture there tells 1,000 words, and I won't spend a lot of time on it, but this is a picture. And that's the member standing there in the middle of that picture. This was the first install we did in our territory. But again, and a good example of how, in a proactive leadership way, we are bringing renewable energy geothermal loops to our members. The hard thing about geothermal for people is it's very expensive. And so we have a rate tariff where we can install this infrastructure for the member, and we have a rate tariff where they just pay us each month. They don't have to come up with that large amount of money up front. It's been very successful. And the key to that program is our employees are doing the installs. This equipment you see on this slide can be used on the utility side of the business to install cable, and it can be used on the geothermal side of our business to install loops for our members. Page 6 is a very recent picture. We have just broken ground on our very first 40 kW community solar project, and this is located at our headquarters in Pelican Rapids. If you look at the picture to the left, you can see that's our cooperative headquarters. To the right is Highway 59, and if you're familiar with that, a very active highway there with a lot of traffic and a lot of visibility. This is a great site. It's a beautiful site right at our headquarters campus. Great visibility from Highway 59 there, and people can see it, and it's going to get a lot of attention in our community. Standing in the picture is myself along with one of our linemen from our cooperative, and I'm proud to say that if the storm comes through tonight, he can go out and climb a pole in the dark and restore power, and he can also run equipment and install community solar type projects for us now. It's a very exciting time for us at our cooperative. On page 7 is another picture of work that's being done in the last few days at our cooperative. Again, this is a lineman of our cooperative and a GIS technician that have been cross-trained to do this type of work. And it's just a great, this picture is a great example of how we can use our employees with their existing knowledge, skill, and ability and apply that to solar and build a very cost-effective community solar project. Page 8, just another picture for you. And I just want to point out something in this picture. Our cooperative headquarters is built on a campus that's 80 acres and a lot of open space there. And we have restored the area around there to a natural prairie. It's a very, very nice natural setting, and there's nice walking trails through it, and you can see a little bit of the trail kind of in the middle in the upper part of the page. Well, down the road from our cooperative is our school in our community, and teachers bring their students out and do nature walks and things, and so this strategic location is very nice for us in terms of now having a solar array right there, and it will become part of the educational process for the students in our community, which is another thing we're quite proud of. Page 9. What are those things? Those are helical anchors produced by Hubble Corporation. We have worked very closely with Hubble Corporation to design the solar foundation for our 40 kW array. It will take 36 of these anchors installed for our foundation. Last Monday, a gentleman from Atlanta was at our co-op from Hubble. Unfortunately, we got rained out and we couldn't start the project, but he was there to help us start installing these anchors for the first time. If you flip the page to page 10, another picture of our site and our headquarters with the pile of anchors there, and you can see in the middle of the picture there's two anchors at this point that were installed, but we got rained out and had to stop. And now that the rain and the snow has melted, we were able to resume our project today. And then, of course, a solar panel there. We have selected 10K Solar, who is a great partner. Of course, made in Minnesota, trying to keep all the value of this project as local as we can. We really like 10K's technology. This picture on page 11 was just taken this morning. The site was dry enough to get back at the installation. This is a Lake Region Electric truck. This is Lake Region Electric employees installing the solar foundation. This was our first project, first full day of construction, putting the anchors in. And when I left at noon, the two employees doing this, of the 36 anchors, they had almost half of them in by noon. The point is, we can do this, number one. Number two, we can do it very cost effectively and drive costs out of the solar process to make it affordable for all of our members. The last page 12, I put together for you just a summary in bullet form of some of the lessons we've learned, including some of the numbers that are coming out of our project. Again, we are not completed, but we're pretty comfortable with our pricing and the cost estimates that we have, and I'd just like to walk through these very quickly. First of all, as part of our due diligence and our board business plan that they developed, we did a member survey, surveyed our members. That survey came back early on in our process that somewhere between 1,200 and 1,500 of our members are definitely interested in solar. It was a phone survey. Definitely interested in solar was the highest a response they could give us, and so we had 1,200 to 1,500 of our members check the definitely interested box, which really created a lot of enthusiasm at our co-op that we had enough interest to take this to the next level, and now we're actually building the array. Since we've announced at our annual meeting this summer to our members, we now have a list of 102 members who are interested in talking to us about our pricing that we do now have finalized, and they have indicated they're very interested in purchasing a subscription or panel, if you will, out of our first array. We believe we can achieve our goal of solar being good for all members, which is so key to us, particularly in a rural area, and keeping nearly all of the value in the local community. We, of course, are building it ourselves. We're very proud of that. And the model, we believe, can be replicated. Once we're done with this, we want to share this story, and hopefully others will find it valuable to them. An interesting thing about our co-op, of course, is we're non-taxable. We don't have a tax appetite. So we are partnering with the National Renewable Cooperative Organization, or NRCO, as we refer to it, to capture the tax equity benefits of this and the accelerated depreciation. That flows back to, ultimately, to our members in a lower panel price for our project. And the story within the story is, that we have learned so far, is our employees are developing core competencies and skill sets to design and build solar arrays. It's culture change. It's leading by example. They have bought into this. They've taken ownership of it and doing a fantastic job of building this first array. The pricing for our subscriptions, or for a panel, if you will, and so for $1,500, a member can receive their pro rata share of the output of that solar array for the next 20 years. We want this to be affordable to everyone, so we're willing to fractionalize the pricing, if you will, so you could buy, in essence, a half a panel for $750, and that's the way it's being rolled out here initially. We are also are considering a pay-as-you-go option, a $10 a month type option. Again, we want this to be affordable for all of our members to the extent that we can. So under our program, you'll receive a bill credit each month for 20 years for that pro rata share of the output. 13.2 cents per kilowatt hour is what the price equates to. So think about that. You can prepay, in essence, your electricity, buy a panel, and over the next 20 years, you'll get the output of that, and it equates to levelized or locking in to a price of 13.2 cents per kilowatt hour. On your bill, you'll actually get a bill credit of kilowatt hours off your usage. On a per watt basis, again, we're not final on our project, but we think it's going to be about $3.66 per watt And if you think about locking into a price, yeah, today 13.2 is higher than our average retail rate, but the crossover point we project is in about year six. So we assume a 2.5% escalator on our current retail rate. In 6 years, this option will be less expensive from that point forward than our regular rate. We think that'll be attractive enough to have a very successful program. If you want to think about a payback period, a quick calculation there, about 18.2 years, again, assuming a 2.5% escalator on our rates. And what's so unique about our project is the fact that not only we're building it ourselves, and we think we can do it cheaper and drive costs out of the project, but in essence, we're going to be able to create $53,000 of what we call rate benefit for our members by doing it ourselves, by taking current costs that are part of our utility, capitalizing them into the project, and in addition to that, doing the operations and maintenance on the array for the next 20 years. So that piece is really key to us, because that allows me, as CEO, to stand up at our annual meeting with our members and say, this project we're doing, it's not only good for the folks who want to be part of it, but also our entire membership. Cooperative solution, solar solution, and a market-based approach works well for our electric cooperative. Our co-op's community solar project is market-based approach and offers solar electricity. It's a great program. We're very proud of it. We are in the very final stages of finalizing our subscription agreements, and we will be aggressively marketing this to our members in the coming days and weeks. And I feel quite confident that our members are going to, based on the feedback we are getting and the enthusiasm we see in our membership, we think that it'll sell quite rapidly. And it's been a good learning experience so far. And when we're completed, I think we'll have a great story, and we want to continue to share that and be a leader for rural Minnesota and our members. I've also attached for you, for your interest, if you're interested, just our most recent newsletter. And as a cooperative, just a front-back monthly newsletter. On the front page is an article about our co-op. In effect, we just declared our largest capital credit retirement in our history of 76 years. We're giving back $1 million to our local members. And then on the back page is another article, an educational piece and a marketing piece on our community solar project for our members. Thank you very much.
I want to thank you for traveling 3 hours one way, I suppose 6 hours round trip, to do a nice little commercial for us here on what you're doing up there at Lake Region. Mr. Johnson, did you have any comments you wanted to make, or are you just there for
I'm just
entertainment value?
Madam Chair, Joel Johnson from MREA. I'm just here for moral support mainly, but there are some other co-ops that are doing community solar in various stages of either the Wright Hennepin Electric Co-op in the western suburbs has a community solar project up and running, another in construction, and there are another half dozen to a dozen in various stages on the drawing boards. Not all of the same model as the Lake Region project, but they're each looking at different ways of providing value for all of their members.
Wonderful. I wonder, Mr. Thompson, is your contact information on the materials that you gave to us, and maybe on the newsletter on the back piece? Or could we get that from you to send around to members in case they have follow-up questions? They could give you a call or shoot you an email?
Yes.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much for coming and presenting. I think we all learned a lot about your project, and we'll follow up with questions by email and phone.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Yep. We have two more folks who need to go a little bit early tonight. Beth Mercer-Taylor is a member of the Falcon Heights City Council, and they are meeting this evening, so we want to get her on the road to her city council meeting. So she is jumping ahead of Excel. She's going to be providing some feedback on the Excel project. And then we have one other individual who will testify early, because he has to pick up his daughter at the airport. So please state your name and your affiliation.
Hi, I'm Beth Mercer-Taylor, and tonight I'm coming as a member of the Falcon Heights City Council, And I'm also the Sustainability Education Coordinator at the University of Minnesota. Some of you know me when I'm wearing that hat, but tonight I'm wearing my City Council hat. Thank you so very much for moving me up in the schedule. There's a sustainability presentation that's very close to my heart coming on around 7:30, so I'm very pleased to be able to make that. Just to give you a little background on the city of Falcon Heights, we're located in the heart of the metro and home to Minnesota's biggest get-together, the State Fair, as well as the University of Minnesota St. Paul campus. And Falcon Heights is really proud to have achieved national recognition for our sustainability efforts. Our mayor, Peter Lindstrom, and I are frequently called on to present our community's sustainability and our clean energy efforts to audiences like the National League of Cities, the U.S. Green Building Council, and their state counterparts. Falcon Heights' efforts are actually highlighted in law and policy journal articles, conference proceedings, and casebooks, which, as a very small city, we find kind of incredible, but we're very proud. Our city's commitment to sustainability began when Mayor Lindstrom signed the Mayor's Climate Protection Act in 2007, which meant Falcon Heights promised to meet or beat the Kyoto Protocol greenhouse gas emission targets through our own city's actions with regard to energy and related issues like land use. Further, we agreed to urge our state and federal governments to enact carbon reduction policies. Hence, I'm here. This year, we achieved recognition as a third step Green Step City for our suite of best practices in sustainability, including energy. We enacted ordinances to support efficiency and renewables, switched out lights, carefully controlled our own energy systems, and installed a 40-kilowatt array on the roof, solar array, on the roof of our city hall using the Made in Minnesota program and also our firehouse. We organized bulk purchase of solar panels and of insulation materials and hosted workshops for our community with help from the Clean Energy Resource Teams, or CERTs. We measured our energy and emissions starting as a pilot city in the Regional Indicators Project, using a nimble approach, creative staffing strategies, and by building partnerships with other communities and with higher education, we got to the point where we are ready to actually reach our carbon reduction goals that we'd set. A key strategy for us to move forward and reach those goals is to fully support our residents' interest in adopting clean energy and reducing their own household and business greenhouse gas emissions, hence community solar. So it should be no surprise that we have been enthusiastically following and hoping to have community solar rolled out for us to take advantage of. We know in our city already that we have several possible sites for a community solar project. We know we have a burgeoning business sector that's ready to go and maintain a system. We have capable city staff willing to roll up their sleeves and do this, and a wealth of community members. We have an environment commission that's met and talked about this, and folks have expressed interest and called our city to ask if we would be having a community solar garden. We assume that legislation requiring our gas and electric utility, Xcel, to, quote, reasonably allow for the creation, financing, and accessibility of community solar gardens would be our ticket to walking our clean energy talk. We are disappointed to learn that Xcel has proposed a quarterly queuing system that would effectively discriminate against projects like ours in a small city, favoring larger community solar projects only achievable in the largest communities, and also undercompensate community solar hosts and subscribers by appearing to interpret the applicable retail rate in a way that results in the lowest possible rate. The goal should be a fair buy rate, not just the lowest possible buy rate. And to take solar renewable energy credits away from us for no compensation as a condition of project commissioning and interconnection. Among other things, this could prevent our project subscribers from making clean energy marketing claims, and that could be a selling point for us. And finally, to not compensate our community solar project for the unsubscribed energy production that it will deliver to the utility, even though our clean energy would still be used by the utility. There are quite a lot of legitimate reasons that during an initial subscription phase or later during a subscriber churn phase where we might have unsubscribed energy, even though we know and are very confident we have a community interest in the project. So in sum, we don't want to wait any longer to participate with 1,000 other cities around the U.S. and getting serious and walking our talk about our community commitment to clean energy. So thank you.
Thank you. And members, when Xcel presents and when other folks give feedback, we'll definitely have time for questions and answers. But I understand you need to get to your city council meeting, so thanks for taking the time.
Thank you very much.
And then Mr. Hamilton, hopefully we can get you on the road so that you're in time to pick up your daughter at the airport. Thank you for coming, and please state your name and your affiliation.
Thank you. Good evening to all of you. My name is Bryce Hamilton. I'm a 15-year member of the 2,000-member Plymouth Congregational Church in Minneapolis. And as a church, we've been actively engaged for many years in low-income housing and homelessness issues through what was formerly Plymouth Neighborhood Foundation and is now Beacon Interfaith Housing Cooperative. Also, for quite some time, we've been educating ourselves on environmental matters under the leadership from our Caring for Creation Committee. Through forums, speakers, and presentations to our high school youth and at our adult Sunday education hour, a great deal of attention has been given to our carbon footprint, both as a church and as individual citizens. Hence, my church is most interested in the community solar concept. Our hope is that as a large, well-known congregation, our support and participation in a future community solar project would gain public attention and also might serve as a model for other churches and faith-based organizations in the Twin Cities and beyond. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming this evening.
You're welcome.
All right, now Excel gets a chance to present their program before anybody else gets a chance to criticize it. So, please. I think that's only fair, right? Representative Garofalo, I thought it was your wife's birthday.
It is.
Well, we will definitely be done on time, so thanks for being here. Mr. Evans.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with XL Energy. With me is Deb Sundin, also with XL Energy. She can give you a more full introduction when it's her turn to speak, which will be very, very shortly because I'm here mostly to push the button. And though I will open just on this first slide to say that as a result of and in working toward the omnibus energy bill that was passed last session, our goal was to add solar to the balanced energy mix that we think is important to us as a utility. We understand that solar energy can be delivered in a variety of ways. Our customers, as some of whom have spoken here this evening and I imagine will speak later, are interested in the rooftop programs and the solar garden programs, which provide that choice to customers. But we also recognize that large-scale, utility-scale, as we say, solar is a more efficient way and a lower-cost way to deliver solar energy to our customers, and we're looking through the programs that came out of the Omnibus Energy Bill to develop both of those. The bottom line for us is always that the customer solar programs must be sustainable, they must be transparent, and they must be fair to all of our customers, and that's the approach that we've taken to the program. The only part of the program coming out of the bill that has actually been filed with the PUC is our community solar program. Deb Sundin was part of the team, the leadership of the team that put that program together, and so I'm going to turn it over to her to walk through the program.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would like to walk through the program, and if you would like to turn to slide 3, that's where I'll start. And my first couple of slides tonight are, I understand that all of you were involved in the actual creation of the statute that puts us here tonight, but I am going to remind you of a couple of things as we go forward. The statute did define very well what the Solar Gardens program was going to be and how it was going to be designed. So just as a recollection, Solar Gardens is meant to allow for participation from customers that possibly could not put on rooftop arrays, have no interest in rooftop arrays, or for some other reason would like an easier way to participate in renewables. And so there are 3 primary partners in this process. There's the developer of the solar garden and kind of the operator. There are our customers who will eventually be the subscribers to these solar gardens, and also we are involved because we are purchasing the electricity from the solar garden, and we are also providing bill credits for that electricity to the subscribers. So if you switch to slide 4, and this is another kind of summary of the bill, and you can see by this slide that the program design was greatly informed by the statute. So there are certain things that we were able to influence and other things we pulled right from the statute. And I won't go through all of these because they should all recognize a lot of this. But primarily, kind of, it gives guidance on the size of the garden. It gives guidance on subscriber definitions and what kind of the rules the gardens have to follow. So if we go to slide 5, this is the beginning of the crux of our development here. And as you've already heard tonight, there's a couple of things we have developed into the program. The first one is, in the application process, it is going to be a first-come, first-served process. Now, over time, there is no intended cap for solar gardens, but what we have proposed to the commission in our design is for the first 2 years to kind of have a little bit of a limit and cap to help monitor the process in a very new program and something that we really have to watch and institute the first couple of years. There's a lot of angst in the community around this, but to be honest with you, what we are really trying to strive for is to make this a good experience for our customers who are going to be the subscribers, and also make it a good experience for the industry and the community arrays that are going to participate. So what we can do by doing this for the first 2 years is to provide a higher quality of customer service from Excel, make sure we get the engineering of those systems done and analyzed in a time fashion that is acceptable to everybody, and also make sure that our customers are getting on the arrays in a quicker time, so that the expectation when the array is accepted, the developer can tell them how long it's going to take, and the customer will have that expectation and hopefully be fulfilled in that expectation. The next slide, slide 6. We are instituting or requesting for approval to institute 5 categories of program fees. And this is also an area that's we've been out discussing with the industry on these issues and getting some input from them. But the first, let's divide this down. There are 2 sets of fees on this slide, the metering fee and the interconnection fee. That is nothing new. It is something that we instituted on solar arrays for the last 3-4 years. The metering fee is basically just a monthly charge for the metering that has to be put into the home or business to actually monitor the production. The interconnection fee that's on the bottom is to pay for all of the engineering that our distribution engineering group has to do to make sure that the array can interconnect to our system in the appropriate fashion, and to assess whether or not we have to develop any kind of infrastructure improvements on our distribution system to make a way for the array. So the interconnection fee pays for that, as well as if we do have to do improvements, they are charged to the developer. The other categories, the top one, is the application and participation fee. The application fee is a one-time fee that pays for the administration for the program to get it through the approval process. Also, the participation fee, which is an annual fee that will be charged to the subscribers, will help us pay for the ongoing administration of this program. And the favorability of these fees are that it will keep the program sustainable over time without having to depend on other funding sources being approved to support the administration. It can actually fund itself. The other 2 categories that are on the screen, one is the deposit and one is the escrow. Neither of these fees, both of these fees are refundable. So they serve 2 different purposes, but they are fully refundable to the developer as they go through the process. And let me start with the deposit fee. The purpose for the deposit fee is to ensure, again, we're looking at customer service. The subscribers are going to be our customers, and we want to make sure that they are treated well in this process. So what we're looking for is the applications that come into us to be well designed and at a suitable time period so that they can be built out and subscribed to within an 18-month period.
It's a year and a half. We feel it's a very fair time period to put the projects through. And if these projects are completed with 18 months, the deposit is fully refundable to the developer. Now, this particular fee is at risk if the projects eventually do not get built out and subscribed to. And so that those dollars, if we retain those dollars, will actually flow back to our customers to cover some of the costs, I believe through our fuel cost adjustment or one of the adjustments we have. The escrow fee is totally not at risk at all. It will always be refunded to the developer. And it has a slightly different purpose. Basically, what we're doing here is trying to encourage a couple of things. One, again, we want really solid projects before it gets applied to. And then we also want to make sure that if the project falls through or is not going to be implemented, that in a very quick fashion the developer gets back to Xcel Energy and takes the project off of our pipeline list. And then at that time we'll refund that fee.
Let me ask you, do you mind taking questions as we go, or would you like to wait until the end?
I would. Questions as we go are fine.
Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, thank you. Ms. Sundin, welcome to the committee. Help me understand, you might have said it, but I want to be sure we keep this developer and subscriber relationship correct. I know Xcel is advertising this, or will be advertising this program. So do these people who want to subscribe, do they come to you? Do you keep a list? Or is that up to the solar developer? Is that up to them to go out and solicit a list of subscribers and then come to you with a project? Help us understand how that works, can you?
Ms. Sundin.
Chair, Representative. We will not be soliciting subscribers for the gardens. Mm-hmm. What we will be doing is putting out on our website and in other communications what they are, that they are something that we're partnering with the developers on, kind of what the rules are, you know, what to look for when you're working with a developer and deciding to subscribe. But the actual subscribers will be will actually be sold or will be marketed by the developer or garden operator. They will be responsible for signing the subscribers up. They will also be responsible for maintaining subscriptions over the lifetime of the garden.
Okay.
Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, just one quick follow-up then. That helps helps me understand then the relationship. These solar community developers then, any idea about how many there are going to be out there, a handful, a half a dozen, or is there any limit on how many developers can put together projects?
Ms. Sundin.
Chair, Representative Byrd. There is no limit. And we have been approached mm-hmm. by several developers or even communities, as well as, like you heard tonight, churches. Mm-hmm. All different types of people are looking to develop these types of projects. Yeah. But we don't know what the, I mean, there isn't a defined industry or a defined developer group. And we actually probably expect a lot of creativity out there.
Mr. Evans.
Madam Chair, just to add something to that, because it relates to this deposit, one of the experiences that we've had with solar programs is, particularly when there's sort of a race for the money, is that people will put in projects as a placeholder to hold their place in line, even if they're not really totally prepared to go forward with them. And then those projects eventually drop out and other projects move up. The purpose of the deposit is to, and the escrow, is to make sure that when someone's actually filing an application for one of these projects, they have the wherewithal to perform, and they have an incentive to perform, and not just, you know, put in an application so that it sits in line and waits and hopes and prays that it gets put together. So that's one of the purposes of this. And if the project, as it turns out, can't be built, by having the escrow be refundable, they have an incentive to tell us the project can't be built, because that's how they get that money back.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was looking for some clarification, and either testifier can respond. When you're talking about per kilowatt, Are you talking about nameplate, a derated nameplate, since solar efficiency will be dependent on site and installation? So can you help me understand if this is just straight nameplate or if it reflects actual expected production?
Ms. Sundin.
Chair, Representative, subject to check, but I'm pretty sure I'm right, it's based on nameplate to begin with. The system is designed, or the bill credit is designed, to only pay for production. And so when they come in and apply, you know, they will have a system that can, you know, on paper can produce so much, so it is nameplate. We will do all of the numbers based on that, but we will pay out only for those kilowatt hours produced.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A short follow-up. So then, is there anywhere that the people interested in this would have a sort of a truth in investment that would tell them the delta between the nameplate and the projected production or derated value for the site in which they're investing dollars to?
Ms. Sundin.
Chair, Representative, that is the Excel's expectation is that the developer will sit down and go through that with them. We do have, it's further, a little bit further in the presentation, but I can touch on it now. We have worked out what we consider a checklist of basically things that the developers should be going through with the subscribers. We're not asking for all of that to come to us, but what we are asking for is the checklist that has all of these items on it to be signed by the customer that the developer went through it with them. And that will be brought to us in the application process.
Sorry, this is not our Halloween preview show, but I think they might be working on the elevator right now, so we're hopefully going to persuade them to maybe wait a little bit.
Madam Chair, I think it's the Central Corridor they're still working on.
So. That looks pretty good. It's the Southwest we're having a little difficulty with. Ms. Sundin.
A little?
If we can turn to the next slide, which is slide 7. These are the fees that we have proposed to charge on this page. And as I said in the beginning, the application fee is an upfront fee. It's a flat fee. The participation fee is also a flat fee, but it's a per subscriber per year fee that we will charge on their bills. The metering fee is very common. And then the deposit and the escrow is $100 per kW or 10 cents per watt. And then the interconnection fee is variable, and we do have set standard fees based on different size categories.
Can I ask a question on the participation fee? Did you say that's per subscriber or per project?
It's per subscriber for the garden.
On the participation fee. Go ahead.
All right, on slide 8, again, this kind of gets to what I was talking about a little bit earlier. We have been trying to consider how to make sure that the customers do have a good experience and that we have some compatibility across the industry and developers as they put these gardens together. And so we have come forward with what we think are kind of the basics around what the developers should be working through the subscribers with, and the subscribers should have knowledge. So this is the checklist I'm referring to, is on slide 8.
Correct, Ms. Sundin. It's $300 per garden per year, not per subscriber.
Oh, sorry.
I feel a lot better about that.
Okay.
Ms. Sundin.
Costs a lot to run one of these things, you know.
Okay. So if we can move to slide 9. The credit, which has also been a subject of a lot of conversation, as we roll this program out, we are going to use the average retail rate. The intention is to hopefully migrate over to the value of solar as that's developed and approved, and if and to the extent that we can support that going forward. But right now, the legislation requires us to put this program. We had very set dates in the legislation to get this program rolled out. It is going to roll out prior to the value of solar being completed. So the statute does allow us to use retail rate, average retail rate, and that's what we're going to do. It is referred to in Xcel Energy as our A50 tariff. And this rate has a defined methodology for its calculation, and it's actually defined in the Minnesota administrative rules. We file it every December with changes. We calculate it and change it every December. So those gardens that participate early on will be under the average retail rate, or that, at least that's as the statute is designed and what we're asking approval for. And currently, I've given you in the two sub-bullet points what those values are under the tariff this year. On slide 10, this is basically to let you know, and this is in the statute as well, that solar gardens are eligible to participate in both the Made in Minnesota program, which the department will be operating, and the small capacity solar program, which we will refer to as solar rewards. And the issue is that the garden needs to be under 40 kW for the Made in Minnesota program and under 20 kW for the incentive program.
Madam Chair. Representative Yarusso and then Representative Groffler. Representative Yarusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On slide 9, you were talking about the A50 tariff being recalculated every year. Would the rate paid to the subscribers then change every year when that's recalculated, or would it be locked in at whatever the rate was the first year?
Ms. Sundin.
Chair, Representative, it will be locked in. Our intention is that a lot of the financial packages that have to be done to make sure that the gardens are financially viable is dependent on knowing what that rate's going to be. So they will know what the rate is, and that will stay within the 20-year contract.
Representative Groffler.
Thank you. Madam Chair, and for either of our testifiers, why is Xcel only limiting, why are you limiting the Made in Minnesota incentive to those under 40 kilowatts? Why are you doing that?
We are not, Xcel is not doing that, Representative. It is actually in the statute. And the Made in Minnesota is under 40 kW for systems.
Madam Chair, why is
Representative
that?
Groffler.
Why is that?
Representative Groffler, when we passed the statute and we put the program together, I think Representative Moline had a lot of good reasons for establishing it the way that she did. And I know part of it is the economies of scale are different for larger projects, and so smaller projects need more incentives to go forward. And I think the objective was to help the residential market more than the business market. But we could follow up with Representative Moline to see if I'm remembering it right or not.
Yeah, Madam Chair, it seems like this would be, this provision seems like we are mandating the most, we could actually get a lot more solar done if we didn't have this provision in law, that if we didn't have that 40 kilowatt cap on there. A larger project, assumingly you'd have more economies of scale, you'd have more leverage, but I guess that's probably a discussion for a later time. So I'm just, it wasn't Xcel's decision, it's the way the law was written. So thank you.
Ms. Sundin.
Well, I wanted to make reference to the retail rate because one of the earlier testifiers had made reference to how that was selected. You may recall that the intention here with the solar garden was to try to duplicate for solar garden customers what a rooftop customer would experience with a rooftop system. And under net metering, before we get the value of solar, they're going to be under net metering. So their compensation is essentially the offset on their meter, which is at this retail rate. So this rate was not chosen in order to drive the cost down, as some might suggest. It was chosen because it duplicates what a customer receives if they put a rooftop solar up and operate under net metering, which is what will happen until the alternative tariff is chosen.
Thank you. Ms. Sundin.
Okay. If we can go to slide 11. And this is basically the approval process timeline or the regulatory timeline that we're on. We did file with the PUC by September 30th. We did get stakeholder input, but the PUC is also looking for it. Comments are due November 6th by the stakeholders to the PUC in this process. Reply comments are due December 6th. Those will come from us as well as others. And then as soon as we get approval, there's no set time for the PUC to approve or go through the entire approval process, but the statute does set out that we will start the program 90 days after that approval and that we will start crediting accounts within 180 days of that approval. We do expect to get through the PUC regulatory process sometime in first quarter of 2014.
And I'm going to pause on that slide just to make the point that you make in this slide, that this process is going forward at the PUC, and so people who want to have an impact on how the process, how your program gets evaluated and any changes that the PUC might suggest that you make, should definitely submit your comments to the PUC. This is at the regulatory level, not at the legislative level at this point. We're having this hearing to have the conversation, but this hearing does not constitute input to the Public Utilities Commission. So we appreciate everybody who's come tonight to give us feedback, but your feedback will be used by the Public Utilities Commission in the design and approval of the program. So please make sure that you submit your comments to them as well. Ms. Sundin.
Thank you, Chair. And my last slide, basically I'm going to switch gears a little bit and just give you a little bit of update on another program that was impacted by the statute, and that is we're closing out the old solar rewards program that was funded by our SIP funding in DSM, and we are going to be proposing a new solar rewards program under the statute, and we're hoping to file this with the department by October 31st. And I just wanted to basically show in this slide that the new solar rewards program and the old solar rewards program will be very, very similar. There's two major differences between the two, and that was defined by statute. And one is that we're going to go from an upfront capacity-based incentive, which is the current program, to a production-based incentive that will be paid over 10 years. To the customers. And this can apply, this applies to rooftop solar applications, and solar rewards also can go into the gardens, but if it solar rewards is used as a garden, they will get the incentive over 10 years, and then they will also get the bill credit from the garden. The other major difference is that our current solar reward program goes to 40 kW, and the new one will be limited to 20 kW. And that's the end of my presentation, and thank you.
Questions from members? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I want to say I was pleased to see Xcel's average retail rate is 7% lower than Lake Region. You must be doing something good, but I was curious in the presentation from Lake Region, they had 10K solar made in Minnesota. I was would like to have an understanding of, are there some vendors that you're utilizing for made in Minnesota? And then for those vendors, and you probably don't have it available, if you could send the committee the percent of materials, the BOM percent, dollars manufactured in Minnesota, and then where the actual original manufacturing of the cells themselves are, whether it be the U.S. or a different country.
Ms. Sundin.
Chair, Representative, you know, the first thing I would like to clarify is that the Made in Minnesota program is not going to be operated by Xcel Energy. It will be operated by the Department of Commerce. And they are currently developing that program. There are criteria, however, having said that, there are criteria that the manufacturers to qualify for their product, to qualify for that program, that the department will be certifying those manufacturers. And right now I believe there's two that have been certified, at least they were certified through our Minnesota bonus program, which is Made in Minnesota as a replacement for that. But I believe there's others talking to the department as well.
Follow-up, Representative Quam.
Madam Chair, thank you. I I guess what I was after was who is out there, and then it'd be nice to understand where they're getting the panels from. You know, it allows you to understand reliability and some of those details. I am aware of the criteria we set in the legislation of what defines, and unfortunately, dollars on bomb percentage is not really pertinent into that definition, but it's something I'd like to know because it does help us to understand the progression of the technology and the costs and when it'll become affordable cost point-wise to be able to do this on more homes. So I was mining for something that might be useful in the back pocket, and I apologize for not stating it clearly enough. Thank you.
Representative Quam, it's a good question, and I think at some point we'll have the Department of Commerce come before the committee and tell us about the Made in Minnesota program once they get it crafted. But my understanding is that one's not imminent. So, Mr. Evans, did you have any feedback? Any other questions from members for Excel? My only reflection for you, and it's just, it's petty, is you don't have to call it gardens, because I think that's confusing to people. But I don't think there's anything in the statute that requires you to call them gardens. The word was just in there because we didn't really have time to take it out at the end of session. But I think to the extent you can change it from calling it solar gardens. I know you call it that in Colorado, but I think here in Minnesota maybe it's when we talk about solar gardens, people get confused. They think we're planting things.
Madam Chair, I have some suggestions.
Representative Crum, you can maybe submit those in writing by email to Mr. Evans. I'm sure he would find them entertaining.
Madam Chair, actually we haven't actually set on a name for the program yet. We are doing what we do in marketing and trying to decide what the appropriate name should be, and so we can take your input.
The slide that reflected solar rewards is also, I don't think we've settled on that either. The solar rewards is what we called our old program. We may differentiate that and call it something new when we put the new program together.
I think it's always good when customers know what they're buying, and I don't know if garden communicates that, so... thank you for your presentation. We might have you back up at the end to respond if you feel like you'd like to. And now we'll go to the folks who have signed up. I think we have them in order that they signed up. The first person on the list is Ross Abbey. Good evening. Welcome back to the committee. As you know, go ahead and state your name and your affiliation and then proceed.
Good evening. My name is Ross Abbey. I'm a policy associate of Fresh Energy, and Fresh Energy is a nonprofit group that works to transform widely held economic and environmental ideas into smart policy. Personally, I hold degrees in engineering and law, and the last time I was here was back in February with Michael Noble, who unfortunately can't be here tonight but sends his regards, and we were testifying in support of Representative Morgan's bill, which introduced the community solar framework legislation that was ultimately passed into law with some amendments. I'd like to thank Xcel Energy for filing this proposed implementation plan, which represents an important step in bringing community solar gardens closer to reality. Fresh Energy enjoyed working with Xcel to hammer out the statute, and we look forward to continued dialogue and discussion with all stakeholders. So why community solar? Briefly stated, the policy purpose of community solar is to allow customers to self-generate using solar PV, regardless of where they live in the utility service territory or whether or not they own suitable real estate for an on-site solar PV system. There's a tradition in utility regulatory law of viewing utility regulation as a bargain between the utility and society. Viewed in those terms, here's the bargain implicit in the community solar garden statute, at least as I see it. First, we require the self-generator, in this case the subscriber, to a community solar project to cover their full utility costs. Unlike traditional net metering, which, as some utilities have argued, may allow self-generators to avoid paying their full utility costs. Second, we solve the utility's revenue erosion concern. Unlike net metering, which reduces utility sales, community solar gardens do not. We also establish the utility as a monopoly buyer, at least as to the energy produced by the community solar gardens. And yet, at the same time, the statute also treats community solar subscribers as self-generators. We see this in the fact that the community solar statute is couched under Minnesota Statute 216B.164, which governs traditional net metering. Another example is under community solar gardens, we limit the size of an individual subscription to the size of the subscriber's actual energy consumption. So there is that connection to self-consumption. Community solar also allows for the expansion of customer self-generation in a couple of ways. First, it overcomes the co-location requirement that is inherent in traditional net metering. It also reduces the initial cost barrier. With community solar, a subscriber could purchase as little as a single panel, 200 watts, and that cost may in some cases be less than $1,000 compared to the cost of a typical home system, which could be $20,000 or $30,000. Community solar also, in this statute, authorizes third-party ownership, which is allows for a variety of financing models to be incorporated into the projects. So these are the elements of the statutory bargain. Now, as we move into the regulatory phase, we get to debate what is the appropriate balance of these elements relative to one another. I want to return for a moment to the monopoly buyer issue. Now, why do I say that the utility is a monopoly buyer in this case? Under this law, subscribers are not allowed to sell the energy they generate to anyone except for the utility, in this case, Xcel. Unlike traditional net metering, community solar subscribers are also, at least under Xcel's proposal, denied the ability to offset the energy they generate in kilowatt hour terms against their own consumption. Instead, they must sell it all to Xcel at the rate set forth under Xcel's program. This means that the regulator, the commission, will have to do something a little bit different than they normally do. Normally, the commission guards against utility rates being set too high to protect ratepayers from bad utility investments. In this case, the utility will have to guard against the utility setting the rate too low to protect community solar subscribers from being lowballed by the utility. And this may help to explain some aspects of Xcel's proposed implementation plan, which reads to me largely like a one-sided utility procurement contract, as opposed to a general customer right to self-generate off-site. Fresh Energy has at least five major concerns with Xcel's proposed implementation plan, and I'll try to move through these relatively quickly. First, Xcel is proposing to purchase up to 10 megawatts a year for the first 2 years, for a maximum of 20 megawatts during that two-year period. Unfortunately, this would establish an explicit limit on the amount of community solar that can be developed within the first 2 years. In practice, this capacity limit would also restrict the number of community solar projects that can go forward and the number of subscribers that can participate. Second, Xcel would also establish an unnecessary project approval queue. This queue would limit approval and interconnection to the first projects that apply during a given quarterly window. The queuing system would discriminate against small and medium-sized community solar projects, for example, a 40-kilowatt size system you might see on a small business or a church, because as few as three large projects could soak up the entire capacity for a given three-month window. The queuing system also encourages community groups and developers to rush to meet an arbitrary deadline, creating the gold rush effect that Xcel says they want to try to avoid in this case. Third, there are a number of concerns regarding Xcel's proposed compensation for the daytime energy that community solar projects will deliver to the utility. And I've got 5 points on this. First, in this filing, Xcel does appear to be attempting to interpret applicable retail rates. That's the phrase in the statute, applicable retail rate. And it's maybe an obvious thing to point out, but that phrase is different than average retail rate. They're interpreting that phrase in a way that does seem to result in the lowest possible rate, among the many interpretations that they could choose to apply to that term. Second, Xcel specifies a 20-year fixed contract in the utility's own favor. That is, the fixed rate would apply for the full 20 years, but it would be based on the applicable retail rate for the first year, rather than, for example, a 20-year average or a floating rate, as was mentioned. Third, Xcel proposes to provide no compensation for the production that's delivered to the utility by the unsubscribed portion of the projects. In other words, if a project goes forward and gets built, but they've only subscribed out 80% of the capacity, well, the additional 20% of the capacity would still be generating power, delivering to the utility, providing value, but under Xcel's proposal, there would be no compensation to the project for that energy. Fourth, Xcel proposes to pay no interest on the refundable deposit and escrow fees, which for a 1-megawatt system, those fees combined could be on the order of $200,000. So interest does seem like an issue there. And last but not least, Xcel would require the mandatory transfer of the project's solar renewable energy credits, or SRECs, from the project to the utility as a condition for interconnection. This is something very different from what we have seen traditionally over the last 30 years with net metering, which does not require transfer of the renewable energy credits. Same is true of interconnection. Traditionally, you don't have to transfer the credits simply to be interconnected to the system. And this is problematic for a number of reasons. First, mandatory transfer would make community solar gardens ineligible for production-based incentives, such as the new solar awards or the Made in Minnesota incentive. And these incentives could otherwise be captured by, you know, small systems, 20 kilowatts, 40 kilowatts. Second, mandatory transfer would prevent community solar gardens from making certain marketing claims. And I think one of the earlier testifiers remarked on this. The way it works is a business might want to subscribe to part of a large system, and be able to tell their customers, you know, our business is 100% powered by clean energy. And the way they're allowed to do that is by retaining the solar credits and retiring them themselves. And that prevents another entity, such as the utility, from taking the credit for those RECs. So those sort of marketing claims might not be allowable under Xcel's proposed program. And then, to cap it all off, Xcel is proposing to pay 0 cents per kilowatt hour, or $0 per watt, compensation for these solar credits that it would take through this contract. And again, that's a departure from the standard practice up until this date. The fourth area of concern, remember I've got five areas of concern that I want to raise with you tonight. The fourth area is that Xcel proposes a number of restrictive eligibility requirements. And the market impact of these requirements will be to reduce the number of eligible projects and to increase the costs for those projects that do succeed in clearing the eligibility hurdles. A better practice is to implement any necessary requirements through the interconnection screening process, which generally focuses on the hardware and the engineering requirements that those standards you need to meet to connect to the system. Fifth area of concern, and then I'll wrap up my testimony. Xcel is proposing 7 different types of fees that it would apply to each and every community solar project, no matter the project size. And in many cases, these fees must be paid before the project has a chance to go out and get subscribers, for example. And we saw the list before, but I wanted to just repeat it one more time. Here's the list of proposed fee types: application fee, participation fee, metering fee, deposit, escrow, and interconnection fee. Meanwhile, the statute only gives utilities explicit authorization to recover their reasonable interconnection costs. And that's in paragraph E1. So, what is the impact of these proposed fees? Well, for a 1-megawatt system, the largest size, we're looking at an upfront project fees of over $200,000. And that's before any interconnection costs. And remember, those are a little bit unknown until you actually apply. That level of upfront costs would basically require these projects to go out and get third-party project financing, which they may be able to avoid having to do, but for high upfront fees. For smaller projects, the proposed fees are even more burdensome, especially on a price per watt basis. For example, for a small 15 kilowatt project, what you might see on a church or a small business, the fees work out to roughly 90 cents per watt. And I want to give you two quick points of comparison just to put that number in perspective. First, the Department of Energy has established a 2020 goal for residential installed costs, those are even smaller systems, of $1.50 a watt. Compare that to Xcel's fees of 90 cents per watt. Second, the bulk price for community solar panels today is already less than $1 a watt. So with Xcel's proposed fee schedule, we could expect some small community solar projects, the fees would actually be displacing panel as the single biggest cost component of the project, which seems like an issue. In closing, I'd like to thank you for the chance to testify and also for the chance for others to also provide testimony. Fresh Energy, we look forward to working with the commission, the committee, Xcel, and other stakeholders to establish a community solar implementation plan that will work for everyone. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This testifier brought up some questions I wish staff could clarify. The statute as it stands, does a utility, is that required to purchase all solar that's installed, small solar installed within their area?
Mr. Eliff.
As I understand it, the utility is required to purchase all solar from each project. The projects must be within the utility's service area.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the testifier can be relieved of the concern that there would be portions of unsubscribed or et cetera that wouldn't be purchased because our statute requires utilities to buy it. And then at the end, I wish we'd get an opportunity to go through all the points in the testimony and have staff take care of anything that is a misconception from the statute as passed, because it seems as if there's some confusion there. And maybe that summary would take care of some of the questions that would be building up through the testifiers. In other words, if staff recognizes that, you know, as this point, that, you know, wouldn't have to be concerned about individuals putting on their houses and you know, businesses and et cetera, because it's falls in a category that's not, and forgive me for using the common term of garden for this, but maybe that would be nice to help clarify both for us and the audience, because this is not a simple, straightforward, understandable, it's just fairly complex subject. So I would appreciate that assistance.
Mr. Abbey, did you want to more clearly state your concern about the unsubscribed portion? I think maybe Representative Kwan didn't completely understand your testimony on that point. Mr. Abbey.
Yes, Chair, Representative. It is my understanding, reading the legislation, that Xcel will take all energy produced by these systems. And so I suppose they will be buying it in that sense. But Xcel is proposing that for the unsubscribed portion of the system, they would buy it at a rate of 0 cents per kilowatt hour.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I assume that the staff could contradict me and correct me, but nowhere in the legislation that passed this past session is there a loophole that allows a utility to purchase for 0 cents. So I guess I'm confused as to why that is even a concern if it's not allowed.
Representative Quam, I think that's why folks are raising that concern about the proposed program. Mr. Eliff, did you have some clarifying words for us on the topic?
Madam Chair and Representative Quam, the legislation doesn't prevent it. It also doesn't say it can happen. I mean, I think, as I understand Mr. Abbey's point, he's saying legislation requires that all the generation produced be purchased by the utility, but it doesn't specify. It specifies a price, but here's the bottom line. The legislation does not address unsubscribed energy. So that is something that the commission is going to have to determine how it gets used. Or the legislature can clarify that in next session's statute.
Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, if I saw that Representative Beard had a question, maybe it's related to this topic. I have a different question for a different topic, so I would defer to him if he has a question related.
Representative Beard, are you in the to that point category?
Yes, I am. Thank you. First of all, I just reminded Madam Chair, when we created the seabed scheme of things, we were back here five sessions in a row trying to tweak that so that it could work. Just oh, by the way, but to this point, if the solar garden scheme is oversubscribed, and I had solar panels on my house, why wouldn't I just go to net metering? Then I wouldn't get a zero rate, I'd get the retail rate. Why wouldn't I just do that? Is there anything to prohibit me from doing that?
Mr. Abbey.
Chair, Representative. If you had a house with a roof that was suitable for solar and you had the upfront capital required to do solar, or you were able to access the financing on attractive terms, you could, and you might, but the majority of Minnesota homeowners, let alone all Minnesota renters and people underage and nursing homes, not everyone has the ability to do solar on site.
Representative Beard. I don't think there's a situation where you can be oversubscribed.
Okay.
In a community solar project.
Well, then I think it must be a moot point we're discussing here, and the 0 cent thing must be...
It's the undersubscribed problem.
Okay.
So... Representative Scott.
Thank you. My questions were for someone from XL Energy, either Mr. Evans or Ms. Sundin, in response to some of the comments made. Is that okay to ask them to come forward?
Sure. It's not super legible, just by the way. Do we have another chair? Yeah, there you go. All right, Representative Scott.
All right, thank you. In response to the testifier, Mr. Abbey's questions or his concerns about all the upfront fees, I'm just wondering if those fees were meant to cover your expected costs.
Ms. Sundin.
Chair, Representative. Yes, the fees that we are going to retain are meant to cover our respective costs. The fees that are reimbursable, as in the deposit and the escrow, are not meant to cover our cost. It is meant for other purposes.
Representative Scott.
I think Mr.
I just want to add, to put this in some context. Current prices, a 1 megawatt community solar project would cost on the order of $2 to $2.5 million. So we're not, if you think of the largest deposit and escrow that you would have to put up would be on a 1 megawatt system, and it would be $200,000 under our formula. So while that obviously is a lot of money, you've got to think about the scope of what this person who's proposing this is proposing and going out and selling to our customers. It is a significant project, and our belief is it's reasonable to request that they make the deposit to show that they're serious, that they're ready to go forward, and that they're at risk if they don't go forward as they've proposed, and also to give them the incentive to come back to us and say, you know what, it's not going to work out, so that they don't essentially take that much capacity in the program and sort of sit on it.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then if your numbers are off and if there's any uncovered costs by the fees that you've projected and crunched the numbers for, will those costs then be passed on to ratepayers that aren't involved with, non-subscribers to the solar?
Ms. Sundin.
Chair, Representative, yes, as we've planned it right now and are asking approval for, they would flow back to all customers.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, our next, Representative Falk and then Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess, and I, just to my good friend Representative Beard, I know he likes to pick on CBED every now and again, and it's one of the things that, you know, if we actually had but the people who wanted to make it work instead of it getting completely trying to be everything to everybody, I think the legislation would work. But, I mean, and it is working in certain cases, but we also have to remember, too, that the Innovative Energy Project hasn't exactly worked. You know, the coal gasification boondoggle hasn't really worked either. So, I mean, it's one of the things where, you know, we should be consistent in some of our bashing of different political ideas or policies.
Representative Garofalo.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. Under point two of point three, you were discussing the 20-year contract and then the rate. And I'm just going to state what I thought I heard you say, and then you can tell me if I'm right or wrong, and then we can just hear from Excel from it. Is that you're basically saying they're taking the retail rate that it is now and locking that in for 20 years in terms of what they're paying for the solar reimbursement rate? They're not adjusting that upward as rates go up?
Mr. Abbey.
Chair, Representative. That's my reading of the proposal, is that they're going to peg the applicable retail rate using a 2013 value, and then the utility will be able to procure or, you know, take the power over the course of 20 years at that fixed rate.
Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo, would you like Excel to address it?
Please.
Well,
Mr.
Abbott. I guess I'm a little confused. It's been my understanding that whether it's a rooftop system or a community solar system, the idea is to give the developer or the homeowner a predictable flow of cash so that he or she can go get their financing. So the idea has always been, including with the value of solar, that's going to be adjusted every single year. You get the value of solar that exists when you sign your contract, and that carries you for your 20-year project. You're going to have a hard time getting a project if you can't tell your banker that I'm going to get the same price next year that I got last year and the same price the year after that. If you're at risk that the price should drop and you would not get the income from your solar panels that you expected, your banker's going to take that into consideration before he or she makes you a loan. So I guess I'm a little confused because I thought the whole point of this was to lock people into a contract where they could know what their income was going to be over the 20 years life of the contract, not to have it continue to move up and down annually so they don't know if they're going to make it or not make it year after year.
And that is my recollection of the conversation we had during the bill development and during the bill passage. Next on our list we have Elizabeth Glidden from the City of Minneapolis. Please state your name and your affiliation and go ahead.
Thank you very much. My name is Elizabeth Glidden, and I am one of the council members from the City of Minneapolis, and I'm here also with me for moral support in particulars, if there are questions, is Gail Prest, who is our sustainability director at the City of Minneapolis. And I want to say thank you very much to the chair and to the entire committee for the opportunity to comment today. We appreciate the ability to have a public and transparent discussion about the proposed solar community garden initiative. And I would say from the perspective of the City of Minneapolis, we are very excited about this opportunity to participate and for our residents and businesses to participate in solar community gardens in these concepts. We know, and I can tell from personal experience, when we have meetings to introduce solar opportunities, we have dozens of residents show up. I have many businesses just in the area that I represent, which is small business territory, who have gone through what I will say is a lot of process and a lot of challenge sometimes to put solar arrays on their rooftops. And we know that there can be more, especially for those who don't own their buildings or don't own their properties or don't have good access for solar. From the City of Minneapolis perspective, we are also testifying because we have worked very hard to jumpstart and make it easier for average people to purchase and install solar. Thanks to a federal Solar America Communities grant and the work of Gail Prest and her team, we have worked very hard to reduce and streamline cost of city permits and process, cutting red tape and engaging the public. We have 7 solar PV projects totaling over 800 kilowatts on city buildings, including almost 3,000 solar panels on the Minneapolis Convention Center. From these experiences, we know firsthand how hard it can be for people to install and use solar in Minnesota, and even for our very experienced city staff, how, again, challenging sometimes it is to work through all these implementation processes. We're interested in how this might work smoother and better. Minneapolis has a climate action plan which directs us to move forward with utilizing more renewables and gives us aggressive goals to meet to reduce our carbon footprint. I'm also the city's representative as the co-chair of something called Think Green, which is a partnership with the City of St. Paul, and this is where we have been working with the private sector to try to translate how we talk about green policy into how we make concrete job opportunities. And some of those job opportunities are, of course, in the solar industry. We are in support, I would say, of many of the concerns that are being raised by others testifying today. We know that working on solar community gardens is not new for Xcel. They bring very valuable experience, in part based on their experience around the country. Boulder, Colorado is a specific experience that is cited by many. And it's very important that the state of Minnesota is able to move swiftly to make this program come to fruition in order to take advantage of federal tax credits, which expire in 2016. So this is a very specific opportunity that we want to ensure that folks have the opportunity to take advantage of with community solar gardens. Based also on our experience with solar projects on city buildings, we know the challenges that can come with inadequate staffing resources in managing Xcel's solar programs. We want to ensure that these are experiences that can be corrected to assist with the community solar garden concepts, to have properly trained and managed staff and resources that can help implement the program and the interconnections in a timely and efficient manner, and to also administer the proper billing procedures. Some of our concerns that I'll mention more specifically are with the proposed bill credit compensation, and you just had quite a bit of testimony around that. Some of those concerns have to be around Xcel taking all of the value of renewable energy credits, the end-of-year remaining solar credits rollovers, and unsubscribed solar without compensation to the solar subscribers. We are also quite concerned with the initial quarterly cap of 2.5 megawatts, and we do not believe that it is necessary at this time. We think that there's been a lot of learning in the state of Minnesota that there are problems with caps in the solar rewards program. And in fact, there was testimony just at the initial part of this hearing from Xcel itself that there are challenges with caps and that you kind of have a jump into the queue without being ready effect. And by removing that cap, you can also address some of the transaction cost issues that were brought up by Xcel, which were in fact to ensure that when developers move forward with the program that they are ready. And finally, I'd like to ask this committee to ask some more challenging questions about the transaction costs. There, we heard the long list of transaction costs, and as a local government unit, I am very experienced, I would say, in understanding that there is a great need both to understand what are your costs, What are those administrative costs that you truly need to recoup and put in, but that there we should be challenged on whether those costs are necessary and are related to the issue at hand. When I read through the submittal, I noticed the list of costs, but I did not see the justification for the itemized list of costs that you saw. And so I just would ask that those be taken a little harder look at those costs, because by increasing both the complications as well as the total cost of the project, we are again creating a situation where we're not going to be able to serve the interests of the public. Thank you again very much for the opportunity to comment. We can take questions if you have them.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and since Councilmember Glidden, who's a wonderful council member in the ward next to where I live, asked this question, as well as Mr. Abbey, about the fees, I guess it would be appropriate to have Mr. Evans or XL talk a little about the fees, why there are so many of them, why they're so high, along the lines that Councilmember Glidden and Mr. Abbey were questioning, so that maybe it would be appropriate to bring them up and respond to that.
Mr. Evans or Ms. Sundin?
Should I stay or go?
And does anybody have any questions for Councilmember Glidden? Mr. Evans, to the fees.
Well, Madam Chair, I'll vacate the chair for someone more qualified to talk about this, depending on how much detail you want to get into. I think that, you know, from our point of view, one of the things that we urged the legislature to do in passing the legislation, and the legislature did, was to submit this process to the Public Utilities Commission, which is a very open process, actively participated in by all kinds of participants, including Fresh Energy and the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and everybody else who wants to come in and weigh in. And they're, you know, quite experienced. They have an excellent staff, and as well as, I should mention, the Department of Commerce will weigh in as well. And the purpose of going to the Public Utilities Commission was to iron out many of these issues. We didn't put all of this stuff in the statute down to the finest detail. We put it in to say, XL, propose a program, put it in front of the Public Utilities Commission. The intention of what the legislature wanted to accomplish is stated in the statute, and let the staff, in an adversarial process, which is what the PUC will undertake, weigh what we have to say about why these fees are justified, what someone else might say about why they're not, and come to the decision. That's what, in my opinion, that's what we have the PUC for. So I don't know if I have anybody here who's prepared to get down into the nitty-gritty of how these fees were calculated, but I can assure you that the PUC is not going to just take these fees that we've proposed in our filing and say, well, if it's good enough for you, it's good enough for us. That's going to be examined.
I think that's enough detail for now, because it's 8:08 and we have two other testifiers, and we definitely will be adjourning at 8:30. Any follow-up?
No, thank you. I appreciate that, Madam Chair, and I just would want to make sure that these fees are not going to be barriers for participation in the program, because that would be counterproductive to what I think the legislative intent is. So thank you.
Representative Scott.
I just had a comment, I guess, since Mr. Evans stepped away, and we're kind of just going to leave this to get more details later. But if they have done projects similar to this in other places, then I'm guessing they have something to base those numbers on. So I'll wait to see the numbers that when they enumerate them.
Thank you. Mr. Hinkle, go ahead and state your name and your affiliation, and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Hinkle. I'm policy director for the Minnesota Solar Energy Industry Association. No stranger to this committee, and gratefully, it was gratifying that this committee and members of the Senate ratified a bill that contains many elements that, quite frankly, we worked on in partnership with Excel throughout the last session. And I'd like to put some of our comments about community solar gardens in that context, because I think it's easy for us to kind of lose track of some of the things that are going on with solar and business and job development in our state as a result of this legislation. First of all, you know, we were supported in this legislative initiative around the Made in Minnesota provisions. Xcel repeatedly indicated their support and has continued in implementation to support the rollout of Made in Minnesota provisions. You know, we have a carve out for that part of the market. And I just want to comment that that's also been one of the areas that we've partnered with Xcel, and that is the concept that we need to grow a diverse market that has a number of segments. So we're not just growing small residential, small commercial. We're going to make sure that that's preserved and retained in the legislation. We're also going to grow manufacturing in the state with Made in Minnesota provisions. We shifted away from a rebate that was nameplate-based to a performance-based incentive that provides an incentive for production and higher performance. It's a better market driver. We were supported in general with the concept of implementing community solar gardens in the state. And we heard you know, the concerns that were articulated by Xcel and other utilities that there were problems with net metering. And part of the fix that we agreed on was to implement what we call a value of solar rate or a value of solar tariff. And that process, stakeholder process, is underway right now, and some of you, you know, may be a part of that. What this has produced is a examination of a market in Minnesota that we've never seen before. We have a number of companies, manufacturers. There are two that one has already come to our state, toured, listened to the opportunities and the assets that our state provides. We have another that is in the process of setting up that interview process. And we have a number of developers that, quite honestly, would not be in the process of looking at Minnesota were it not for the suite of policies that include community solar gardens that are in place right now. So what this is doing is creating an enormous business jobs development opportunity in the state. Mencia and our members have been in active discussion with Xcel and will continue to be about some of our concerns. They are focused primarily around the cap issue. You've heard some of that. Our concern is twofold in relation to the cap. Number one, even though we certainly agree that we need to have an ultimate customer experience going forward with community solar gardens and embrace the idea that going through the launch period, we're going to have to take steps to ensure that customer experience. We're very concerned about the second year, in particular, having significant constraints on the ability to use the investment tax credit that is likely to sunset in 2016. That would be a serious blow to cost effectiveness. And the other constraint on cost effectiveness is that to reach the price points that we think are going to make community solar gardens workable, which is going to be in the neighborhood of 1 megawatt, that means that when these developers, our developers and installers, come in with projects, they're going to limit the number of installers artificially to projects that actually are not going to be cost effective. So let's just say you've got three 1 megawatt projects, and the cap is 2.5. You've effectively excluded one of the most cost-effective projects from being implemented and moving forward. I know that's not the intent, but I think in the process of our talking about this with Xcel, that's one of the things that needs to be worked out, and we're hoping that folks here this evening would weigh in with us to make sure that that unintended consequence doesn't go forward. In terms of the rate, right now it's real clear in the legislation that there's a balancing between the applicable retail rate, which was intended to be a floor, as an interim going forward, as we discuss the value of solar rate on a longer-term process. That applicable rate is balanced against other language in the bill that says that there have to be provisions to reasonably provide for financing and access to community solar gardens. It's our contention that there is not that reasonable access to financing in the rate that is set at this point. We think there are a number of opportunities in our discussion with Excel to explore how to integrate a net present value calculation with the applicable retail rate that folds in the demand charge credit as well. We think there are opportunities for us to discuss the environmental value, how to value carbon going forward, as well as other testifiers, and I'm not going to spend any time talking about it, how to really put a proper pricing on SRECs. It's obvious that now with a compliance of 1.5% by 2020, that whatever that value for SRECs has been in the past, it's going to change significantly, and our subscribers need to be compensated properly for that increase in value that SRECs will represent. And finally, in terms of how to actually construct a rate that is going to make these projects work, we think there's a real opportunity in our discussion with Excel to examine how to place in a beneficial manner community solar gardens in their grid. That we understand that while their overall load may be shrinking, we know that there are hot spots and there are congestion reliability issues at the distribution and feeder level throughout the system. And we think that community solar gardens will play a significant role in benefiting Excel and ratepayers in providing generation in those hotspots. I'll conclude with two cautions. We want to make sure that what we're doing, while is not Minnesota-centric, certainly pays attention to the primary driver that this bill aligned itself with during the last session, which was to create economic development in this state. We know that there are going to be third-party developers that are going to come into the state. We know there are going to be other out-of-state, if you will, and potentially out-of-country producers and developers. But, the intent was to make sure that we were able to capture as much of this development value for our communities, for our members, for our constituents. The final caution would be to make sure that we separate the discussion about community solar gardens from the discussion about the value of solar rate. Just so folks in this room understand, Mencia doesn't see this as a shadow negotiation. This is a genuine negotiation about a rate for community solar gardens and understanding their particular characteristics. And that, to a certain extent, while there's some overlap, has to be separated and distinguished from the longer-term discussion about how to construct the value of solar rate. So with those comments, I'll conclude and stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hinkle. I think we're going to have Mr. Bradley testify, and then we'll do questions for both if there's any time left.
Okay.
Mr. Bradley.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the time to speak today. My name is Ken Bradley, and I'm the CEO for Minnesota Community Solar. We're the first turnkey community solar company in Minnesota, and we've already starting to develop our first project in Minneapolis, which is located on Lake Street, which is on the Northern Sun Building. I just have a few comments to make regarding Excel's proposal. First, I want to thank them for their work. There's a lot of it that we agree with and we think is good and sound, but of course, like others, we have some disagreements as well. Excel said that this is, Rick Evans had talked about, this is an option for retail customers to get solar, and it really is. It's a community solar or shared solar is really an opportunity that 80% of the consumers can participate in. All you need to be is a ratepayer. You can be a renter or live in a condo, and you can decide you're going to move a year from now or 2 years from now, and you can make that investment, and it makes a perfectly it's a perfectly good decision for those consumers to make that decision. The issues I think that we see with XL's proposal, most of this you've heard before, but I'll say it again. The cap, we think there's issues. One is it's not market friendly, and it does not allow for really economies of scale to actually work. Once you cap the market for a business like ours, the more projects we're able to develop, the more we can bring costs down, the fewer, the more prices will go up. Again, the investment tax credit, which was talked about earlier, that's probably one of the biggest aspects that can help drive the cost down of the projects. If we are only going to do 2.5% per quarter, and XL has talked about starting to do this program, taking applications in the second quarter of next year, we're really actually not talking about even doing 10 between now and 2016 when it caps off. We're really talking about during that period about seven megawatts a year is what we'd average, which is significantly, I think, it will hurt the market and ultimately bring up prices for consumers. The fees, this was addressed by several other folks, but I think if you compare the fees, and if we were to do a comparison to Colorado, and Colorado, XL has said, is one of the reasons that they like the community solar, is they have experience with it in Colorado. And if you look and you compare the costs in Colorado, there is $6,700 of costs if you look at the application fee and if you look at the participation fee that we have that developers in Colorado do not have. So there's significantly more costs associated with it. I do believe that the amounts of money that they want for reserve, I think that in many ways that is fair, but I do think that maybe they should think about that differently from a megawatt project versus a 40-kilowatt project, because it's probably a bigger burdensome to a smaller project than a larger, and that should maybe be thought about. But I do think it makes sense to have some reserve fees to ensure that projects are viable, and I think that that's fair that XL wants to have that, and I think it makes sense. It's just really what the amount is. When we look at the rate, there's a variety of things. First, they say they're using the A50 rate, but other rates like this actually have a 2.5% increase in rate every single year, and XL's talking about no increase in rate at all, rates that are similar to this. So it stays flat at that rate. Essentially what they're saying is 6 to 10 cents a kilowatt hour. If we compare this to wind source and what consumers pay for wind source, and now there's been numerous stories in the newspaper from XL themselves talking about how new wind projects are actually cheaper than existing generation, and they're replacing existing generation with it. Consumers of wind source pay about 13.8 cents for wind source. So that's what they're charging for wind source, but they're going to pay 6 to 10 cents for community solar. In Colorado, they're paying a combination of consumers and developers between 16 to 21 cents is what XL pays. So that'll give you an idea of the rate that they're paying there. So again, you're talking about, you know, 10 to 11 cents cheaper in Minnesota, or rather, 10 to 15 cents cheaper in Minnesota as it is in Colorado. When we look at the REC value and where the REC value stands, again, the Solar Rewards Program is a good example of retail or of solar, and Rick Evans talked about this is really a product being created to help retail consumers get solar. Well, if you look at the Solar Rewards Program and you took the current $1.50 a watt and you used that in the term of a community solar garden and you divided that up and you use that as part of a kilowatt price, under the existing program, that would work out to about 5 cents a kilowatt hour. And in that program, it actually states when they give that money to the consumer for the Solar Rewards Program, it says, in return for this, we will own that credit, that renewable energy, that solar credit. We are paying for that value. That is what we are paying for. So it says they're paying that amount. Under the new program that would be done under the Department of Commerce, which would be 10 years, the actual value would all go up to as much as 10 cents a kilowatt hour. So there is definitely value. And we know that Xcel sees value in carbon benefits and as well as the hedging against fossil fuel prices and other prices. There's significant testimony at the Public Utilities Commission recently related to Monticello nuclear power plant and the increased rates that Xcel is asking to pay for those systems. You know, Xcel, like these consumers are buying power, they go to the Public Utilities Commission every couple years and ask for an increase in rate. And they're asking for Monticello right now, and they repeatedly state the carbon benefits are a significant value that should be the commission should consider. They talk about the hedging on fossil fuel rates and other rates, that's a significant benefit that the commission should consider when they're talking about their increased rate for Monticello. So I think if those benefits apply for nuclear power, that we should surely consider those same exact values to apply for solar energy for consumers as well. A couple things to think about as well. The developers, we are in a situation that is different than traditional solar projects. If you build a commercial project on your property, you own that system, you take care of it, you get the power. As a community solar company, we are responsible for A, the host sites themselves. Often there is a fee associated to pay for that site. There are going to be very rare opportunities where people are going to give their sites or their property or their location away for free. So we have to pay that host site fee. In return, we're also responsible for the insurance of that project over the terms of that contract, and we have to insure it and take care of that responsibility. We're also responsible for the long-term operations and maintenance of that project and any other problems associated with it. So we have to take on those costs as a community solar company, and we have to pass that on to the consumer. Well, for us to be able to afford that, the consumer needs to get a rate that is going to pay for that. That is much different than a typical retail project. And for Xcel, there are benefits that they receive more than they would receive if this was a retail project. So if they had 100 retail consumers that installed solar on their home, there would be 100 interconnections and 100 different places that they'd need to manage that power from. And that's a system operating issue that they have to deal with. If we have 100 community solar consumers at one location, there's one interconnection, one place they have to manage it, and there's an additional value and benefit that the utility receives from that. So we think that community solar not only does it help the consumer, but we believe it benefits the utility greatly as well. And I think that's about all the comments that I have, and I'll, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll take questions if there are any. Otherwise, I think we're 3 minutes away from going home.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In February, we received a testimony from the American Council for Energy Efficient Economy, and the testifier here just said 13.8 cents for wind, when actually in this presentation it shows less than half that for new wind, and I think that might add, where they cost difference when the discussion is new wind is more efficient. And then I noticed we've been talking Xcel, but the Lake Region Electric Co-op presentation was given, and I haven't heard any criticism of that. And in there, payback was in the 19th year of a 20-year project, so I think we need to keep in mind viability for these projects.
Thank you, Representative Quam. I think the 13.8% or 13.8 cents per kilowatt hour that Mr. Bradley referred to is what those of us who are enrolled in the wind source program pay for our electricity to Xcel, and not what Xcel purchases wind for from wind developers. So I think that explains the differential. And I think what Mr. Bradley is arguing, that when Xcel says that they'll pay 10.6 cents per kilowatt hour to somebody who's selling solar energy to Xcel, they're, I think Mr. Bradley would say, ignoring the fact that there's consumers like me enrolled in Windsource who pay 13.8 cents per kilowatt hour for the green energy, the carbon-free energy, in theory. Any other questions from members of the committee? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is maybe just kind of an update question. I have been unable to make the value of solar meetings. I don't know if you're attending those or if Mr. Eliff is. Just kind of an update on the progress of that. And then a follow-up question is, I don't remember how the legislation was left. After they determine, come up with a value of solar, is that, does that come back to the legislature for approval, or is that the Commerce Department that approves that?
Mr. Ely.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, my recollection is that once the department comes up with a generic model as to how the value of solar will be calculated, it then goes to the utilities to do their own calculation based on that model if they desire to have a value of solar tariff.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the legislature has nothing else to do with that unless we attend the meeting?
Representative Scott, that's my understanding, and I don't know when the cutoff is for comments on value of solar to the department or to the PUC, if there'll be a separate comment period after that. Mr. Hinkle.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, I've had a little bit of pushback from folks. There's sort of a rumbling among stakeholders about all of the stakeholder meetings that have been initiated as a result of this legislation. That aside, we've had three value of solar stakeholder meetings so far, and two rounds of comments based on those initial stakeholder meetings. I believe the final comment period will end on December 6th. If that's correct, it's in that range, because we're trying to hit a deadline prior to January, even though the law says that DER has to present its methodology with its values prior to the end of January. They're pushing for a deadline that's faster than that so that we can get something to the PUC. They can go through their process and then turn that over to the utilities to do the calculation based on the idiosyncrasies of their particular systems.
And Representative Scott, we did look at maybe having a conversation about value of solar in the interim, and it's just not there yet. I think it's going to be a longer process. I suspect we won't have good information on value of solar for at least a year, which is a little bit of a problem for developers who want to come into the state and do some things, but there's just a regulatory lag there. We'd rather that the experts take the time to do it right, and that they argue in the regulatory forum. And my understanding is the legislature, we're done with that unless we believe that the regulatory agency didn't interpret our statute correctly. We have two more questions. We're over time, but Representative Yaruso and then Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems like we might need to revisit the issue of the how to deal with unsubscribed capacity. Since there were a number of questions kind of back and forth about that, kind of clarify the contractual relationships, because we've got three different parties involved here, and clarify whose responsibility it is to fill out those contracts, and what's the difference between unsubscribed community solar and an ordinary rooftop commercial installation.
Thank you, Representative Ewers. I definitely have an opinion on that topic, and I think I'll be submitting a letter to the PUC. Representative Beard.
Oh, Madam Chair, I'm going to switch the subject here to a happier topic, if I might.
This is a very happy topic. Representative Beard.
For some of us, I'm sure it is, Madam Chair. But getting on to more significant things like life and the next generation showing up, those of us that are grandparents know how significant a milepost that is. Representative Yaruso has now passed that milepost and has joined the ranks of grandparenthood. And as a grandpa myself, I'd like to welcome her to the best phase of her life.
Congratulations.
Madam Chair, she has pictures and she's happy to show them too.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, members. And I know there'll be people sticking around to have conversation afterwards. But for everybody who would like to be home on time, this meeting is adjourned.